Hi everyone, and welcome to Four Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild world of comics. I am Andrew, and as per usual, I'm joined by my co-host Rob.
Hello!
But no Mick today. He is buried somewhere underneath an avalanche of paperwork.
Yes, that is the reason that we gave to everybody.
Yes. That's why, I'm sorry, I apologise. I forgot the Sinister, as far as we know.
Oh, yes. Mick, we haven't done anything to Mick, honestly. It sounds more suspicious now that I've said it. Like
no, it's okay. Everyone knows the more you deny something, the less suspicious it becomes.
Oh, I'm just making it worse, aren't I?
Listen, there are definitely parts of Mick's body that are currently submerged under a mountain of paint.
Yeah.
And that's all we have to say on the matter. The investigation is still ongoing. This is a very dark start to the show.
See, we could have gone with something easy. Like, Mick is currently running across hills because he's known to do that.
Exactly. He just ran off into the sunset one day.
We tried to stop him, but he'd been doing that couch to 5K a bit too many times.
It's a weird system where you have to collapse back down on a couch every 5K you run.
No.
That's how that works, isn't it? I don't know. Because we are not a sports podcast, we're a comics podcast.
Yes.
And that's why we've been reading some of them there comics.
Yes, we have. Am I kicking off?
Yep, because this is going to be another one of our monthly review specials. So, Bob, what have you got?
I have Confusion to start off with. Confusion in the form of Exiles, the Trial of the Exiles.
Now, I seem to recall it was Mick that covered Volume 1 of Exiles.
I think so. I'm not sure. X-Force did a number on me last week, so I'm still kind of recovering from that. And Exiles didn't help this week. So this is Exiles 7 to 12, I believe it is. And Exiles numbers 7 and 8 was written by Saladin Ahmed, with Rod Rees and Lee Ferguson doing pencils and inks, and Joe Quinones and Joe Rivera doing pencils and inks as well. And then Exiles 9 to 12 was written by Saladin Ahmed and Javier Rodriguez, with inks by Alvaro Lopez, colours by Munza Vincente, and letters by VCs Joe Caramagna. And it starts off with a little bit of a story about the Exiles, how they were formed and various things like that. Tales of the Time Eater and other things. And so, right now, the Exiles, well, Blink, who is a mutant refugee from the Age of Apocalypse timeline, she is currently the leader of the Exiles, and she went through all of the palaver in the first volume, and now she is going through all sorts of palaver to try and get her team back together, because they've all been sent to different parts of the timeline, reality, whatever it is. She's ended up in the Wild West, and she has to take on the Magnus gang in order to try and get her friends back. And along the way, they meet, well, I want to call him Sheriff T'Challa, but around those parts, they call him King.
Heck yeah, they do. Cowboy Black Panther.
Yeah, it's one of the best things. And so with Blink is Wolvie, the cartoon kid Wolverine, and Valkyrie with her flying horse. And so the four of them go to rescue their friends from the Magnus gang. Guess who's in charge of the Magnus gang?
Is Magnus in former host of Mastermind?
No, but you've started, so now you can finish.
Very smooth. No, it is Magneto.
It is.
But like, evil bandit Magneto.
Evil bandit Magneto, but he's nothing.
Like, his big... I love this big purple cape. It's like a poncho now.
Yeah, but he's nothing. He's nothing. He's not a patch on Pastor Xavier.
Of course.
The demented, mind-controlling, religious zealot, Pastor Xavier, who has somehow taken Morph and Nocturne and brainwashed them, then proceeds to kill Valkyrie's horse, Elendil.
Bad Xavier.
Yeah. And
although maybe good Xavier, because horses are the worst.
Things go south a little bit. They kind of win, but they don't. And then things go very, very south and very, very weird when the Watchers turn up and tell them that they're on trial for all tampering with reality, but these are Watchers, and these aren't the Watchers that we know. You know, the benevolent Watchers who are watching over reality but not interfering, because they have a vow of non-interference. They'll only record. These Watchers are angry and jealous and arrogant and everything that a Watcher shouldn't be. And so they proceed to exile the Exiles into their other realities, maybe the ones that they return to, but in some kind of weird endless loop. And it's up to, is it Nate Summers? Iron Lad? Whatever he's called?
Oh, yeah, no, this is one of the rare instances where the Nate isn't a Summers.
Is it Nate Stark, is it?
No, this is Nathan. Is his name just Kang? I think it's Kang. Basically, Iron Lad is like a teenage version of Kang the Conqueror.
Yeah, he is teenage Kang.
Which, I mean, I suppose you did say Summers, and it is the only character with a more convoluted timeline than the Summers family tree.
Yeah, this is true. They managed to escape from the Watchers, but end up in the reality of Aladdin. You know, that Aladdin. Yes, that Aladdin. Not that Aladdin with Will Smith. And not the other Disney Aladdin. There are no blue genies in this. There is a big red Mephisto, but there are no blue genies in this. There also is a Caliph Doom who has somehow convinced himself that TJ, Nocturne, is his wife Scheherazade, and who has been telling him stories for the last several nights or so.
There are several Arabian Nights.
This is definitely Arabian Nights. You have Black Cat and the 40 Thieves. And it just keeps getting weirder and more bizarre. And then you have Blink versus Kamala Khan. As in her friend, old lady Kamala Khan, who is a veteran of the war on whatever it was, I've forgotten. It's very odd. Because these new Watchers are angry at, you know, that Nick Fury who's trapped on the moon as a penance for whatever he did, which nobody really seems to know.
Oh, yeah, just that was... Yeah, that's one of the weird things about Exiles, is it relies on knowledge of, like, an event called Original Sin from back in, like, 2012.
Yeah. And so they're angry about him, which is why they've kind of rebelled against the Watchers, but then the Watchers turn up, as in the real Watchers, the ones who haven't rebelled against what the Watchers are watching and the code of the Watchers and stuff like that. And then they get their backsides handed to them by the real Watchers, even though they're real Watchers. I'm confused.
They were bad guy Watchers, you know, because they had face tattoos.
Yeah. Long story short, Blink is still the leader of the Exiles, and everybody seems to be happy, although some of them died along the way.
Those ones are less happy.
Yes. But I will say one thing. There's a lovely picture of Blink at the end with all of the other members of the Exiles. And one of the best bits about it is you got Sabretooth in there looking like the chirpy old grandpa. Just that chirpy old grandpa Sabretooth doesn't... My mind is rebelling against that image. Yeah,
that's because that is very specifically like the Age of Apocalypse Sabretooth, who is basically Blink's dad.
So there you go. Exiles. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
It's also a lot more fun when you read, like, the first six issues.
Yeah, well, I did. That's the thing. It's just been a while since I read them. So following the events of the first six issues and then having that gap of, say, 2 or 3 months and then reading this.
I mean, I feel like you of all people should know to just kind of lie back and take it. Just kind of let it all wash over you.
Lie back and think of Captain America.
I mean, I was thinking more in the sense of, like, waking up the next morning with like, a glow stick wrapped around your wrist or something.
There have been days when that happened.
Exactly. You took it in the bad direction, Rob.
Yes, okay, right. It's fine. It's all good. Your turn.
Oh, no. Because we're here.
What?
Rob's taken it in the bad direction, which means... I think I have to say it now. So I have been reading a manga series which I apparently have copies of, which I didn't realise I had copies of, and caused a lot of confusion in the Facebook chat.
Yes, you did.
Yep, I've been reading Oh Maidens in Your Savage Season.
Oh.
Story by Mario Kada and art by Naoimoto.
Given the start, I'm not hopeful about this.
Can I read the blurb of the first volume for other of the audience?
Yes.
To see what horrors Rob has wrought.
I didn't rot anything. We got sent this.
You let me have it. You just, while I wasn't expecting it, you snuck up behind me and you just shoved it in there.
Is it like girly girly?
Oh, is it girly girly? One word, three letters, rhymes with vex. When Kazusa enters high school, she joins the literature club, where she leaps from reading innocent fiction to diving into the literary classics. But these novels are a bit more adult than she was prepared for. Between euphemisms like fresh chewy grass and pork stew, crushing on the boy next door, and knowing you want to do that one thing before you die, discovering your budding sexuality is no easy feat.
Oh, God.
As if puberty wasn't awkward enough. The club consists of a brooding writer, the prettiest girl in school, an agreeable comrade, and an outspoken prude. Crumbling over their own discomforts, these five teens get thrown into the chaos of three little letters, S-E-X.
Oh, this sounds awful.
You've given me a manga series about the sexual awakening of a group of teenage girls, Rob.
Oh, man. Oh, no. No, just stop there. Let's move on.
Oh, no, we're not going to stop there. Because you're the worst part, Rob.
What?
Unforgivable of all the sins.
What?
I actually quite like a lot of it.
What?
Yeah, it's like, for the most part, just kind of a fun, awkward little sort of high school comedy.
And it's called All Maidens in Your Savage Season.
It is, yeah, I feel like I was kind of worried about how, let's say, suggestive it might have been going in.
Yeah.
But it is very much kind of like a comedy about how sex is just one of those really awkward subjects, especially when you're a teenager and you've got no idea what you're doing about any of it.
You, I shake my fist at you.
Ain't I a stinker? Yeah, I think it's kind of five stories, of which four I like and one is kind of iffy.
Okay.
And by iffy, I mean, I'll jump ahead to bait, say that fifth one is kind of where I'm like, I'm not sure about this series.
Okay.
It's kind of the story I was worried about.
All right.
But yeah, a lot of them are nice. It's just like Kazusa kind of having to go through this realization of like the boy she lived next door to all her life, who she's thought of as like being a brother. Now suddenly he's grown into a handsome teen and she's having feelings for him.
Yeah.
And that's just a bit awkward and confusing.
Okay.
And like not even like kind of, oh, tee hee hee, am I going to know if I like this boy? But like genuinely, part of me's scared, like I suddenly feel completely different.
Okay, which is a normal teenage reaction, I'd say.
Yeah, I think the book is very good at being like, hi, actually for teens, going through puberty is something that's kind of terrifying.
Okay, that's fair enough.
There's a really nice theme going through it all of kind of even the people who you think are like quite knowledgeable about things. Yeah, they're kind of just as terrified as everyone else is. Just trying to awkwardly bluff their way through life.
Yep, that seems like a fair summation.
Anyway, but then one of the girls, she wants to be a writer. But to be a writer, you've got to know about eroticism.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
Yes, you do, Rob. It's the most important thing. It's the only thing that matters when you're a writer.
Nobody wrote sexy essays about the moon.
Well, they should have, because damn moon. You're looking shiny tonight. You've been waxing. Listen, you put me on the spot, Rob. I can't just come up with sexy moon flirt lines. So anyway, yeah, she, I think her name is Honigo. Yeah, so she starts going on kind of an internet chat room, starting up a conversation with a guy, kind of having a bit of an online relationship, and then they decide to meet. And it turns out, it's the student teacher.
Oh.
And she basically uses that to blackmail him into becoming the advisor for the literature club.
Oh, that's not
good. At all.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like this is one of those occasions. Well, I know I usually come down fairly hard on this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's some kind of more willing to say. I get that this is kind of more just a cultural difference thing, where this is probably supposed to come off a lot more jokey and lighthearted than it does maybe in this culture.
Yeah.
Where, especially because we've had quite a few high-profile cases of teachers having inappropriate relationships with students that just makes it all feel quite predatory. So yeah, the series is definitely probably keep it up for the next... No, bad choice of words.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say anything.
I shall continue to read the series probably for the next couple of volumes. But I am quite worried that the whole thing with what's her name, the teacher, might be moving into a direction I don't like in the slightest.
Yes.
So we shall see.
Yes. As you said, it may be cultural differences, but, well, I'm trying to find a segue, but it's really difficult because I've got The Immortal Hulk, Volume 3, Hulk in Hell.
Hey, speaking of things that are uncomfortable and a bit horrifying.
That's a good segue. And obviously this is by Al Ewing with art by Joe Bennett. And you got inks by Rui Jose, Belladino, Bravo, Rafael Fontares. How do I explain Hulk? Well, how do I explain Immortal Hulk? We've tried several times. Immortal Hulk is amazing, and this time it's Hulk in Hell, but he's got a woman with him.
Oh man, yeah, the reporter lady.
Yeah, the reporter lady is in Hell with Hulk, and there is the green door, and you see the green door. Hulk is on his way to the green door with the reporter lady, but this Hulk is very, very, very wiry and skinny. Somebody turns up who basically surprises them because he says to them, "What's it like, Doc, being the Hulk? I bet it was a gas." Turns out it's Rick Jones.
Yeah, Rick Jones, but like with his eyes missing.
Yep. And so,
also, I like the fact that he talks exclusively in like 60s hip cat lingo.
Yep. But there is also somebody else in Hell. There are also two other people in Hell. One of them is Puck, and the other one is the Absorbing Man. And the two of them decide that they're going to try and sort things out. Because Puck has experience with this sort of thing. In fact, he's probably the only one who's got experience with this sort of thing.
Yes, he has literally been to Hell.
Yep. You've also got Thunderbolt Ross as well in there, who becomes this 3-4 weird armed version of Red Hulk. So Red Hulk and Immortal Hulk start having a fight. And then, yeah, it cuts to where you see Bruce's dad and what looks to be the remains of Bruce Wayne in this column of green light.
Oh, no, not Batman.
So anyway, it goes on to show just how much of a terrible father Bruce's dad actually was. And, yeah, it keeps going with that theme. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because this version of the Hulk is very aware of exactly how much of a monster he is. You know, and
no. They kind of tie it into a lot of like religious concepts, from like an anti-god.
Yeah, they do. But there's this brilliant scene where this giant cloud monster, gamma ray type thing, is going to the column of light, and there's these words going: "I howl through many mouths, I break with many hands. They are themselves, but they are also me." And the report lady says, "Oh no, we're too late. This is, who can fight that? How can we fight that? It's the end." And Immortal Hulk goes, "That creep? He's not the end of the world, McGee." And she goes, "How do you know?" And he just looks at her with those glowing green eyes in that demonic smile going, "Because that's who I am."
That is a very good line.
Yeah, it's...
Also, I want to point out that big green cloud is called the One Below All.
Yep.
Which is a name.
"I have all the power you give me, and my weapon is hate."
Line.
Yeah, this
also,
is...
Also, I have an important horror update.
Ooh?
possibly even more terrifying than a Mortal Hulk. There's a bee outside my window.
Oh, right. Is it inside your window or outside?
Outside for the moment, but it's open, Rob. The window is open.
Hmm. This is where it gets interesting, right? This is where it gets very, very interesting, because Immortal Hulk is separate from Banner. He's talking to Banner, and Banner's basically a broken man by this point. And Hulk just says to him, look, you locked me away for years. I know I scare you. What I do, what I am. But before any of the others, I was there protecting you. I'll always protect you. Because I love you, you stupid kid. Somebody had to. And says, come on home. And I love that bit, because it explains a hell of a lot about the Hulk.
Yeah, I think just like, of all the unexpectedly sweet moments that I thought I was going to see in comics,
yeah,
this was not one of them.
I mean, having that moment right in the middle of what is basically a horror story.
Because yeah, it does just like explain so much about the Hulk and Bruce's relationship.
Yep. And then it just keeps going with this non-stop pace of awesomeness. It's so good. He fights Doc Samson.
You know, this Al Ewing kid, he might not be too bad at the old comics lark.
He's really good at the old comics lark, and he's really good at the horror.
Oh, yeah, I can't wait till we get, I think it's going to be next volume where we get his take on, like, the Abomination.
Oh, yes. Well, you kind of get a foreshadowing of it in this volume.
Actually, yeah, because I think the original kind of Blonsky shows up, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Just very briefly, and then, like, tears his face off or something.
Yeah. Hulk in Hell. If you're a fan of Hulk in general, and you are a part of the mature audience set, I will say, then you really owe it to yourself to read Immortal Hulk. It really is that good.
It is. It's like, it's a great character story and a Cronenbergian body horror.
Yeah.
And also like a treatise on religious concepts.
It is. And the thing is, there's elements of Junji Ito in there.
It does get a bit Junji Ito in places.
Yeah, there's elements of Junji Ito in there, especially with the body horror. It's kind of a cross between Cronenberg and Junji Ito.
But damn it, Rob, now all I can think is, this is my Hulk. It was made just for me.
Yes. Yes. Like
grabbing copies of Immortal Hulk.
That's exactly it. I mean, that would be a very different story if it was the Hulks of whatever mountain it was. Oh, Fault, sorry.
The Hulk Nigma of Amigara Fault.
Yeah. And that Disney movie, Halls, would be a very different movie if it was just Hulks.
Do you know what I'm also very worried about?
What?
That I said the word Hulk Nigma, and my brain immediately just went to, that's Hulk stripper name. I've had a long day, Rob.
Oh, no. I want you to keep that in mind. I want you to keep that in mind for later. That will come in handy later.
Now Hulk wants all of you to make it green.
Now I'm scared you, haven't I?
Yes, very much so. Fortunately, I do not have a good horror thing to segue off of that I've been doing. I do have a Marvel thing, though.
Oh?
So, I've been reading Star Wars Han Solo Imperial Cadet, which is written by Robbie Thompson, with art by pencils by Leonard Kirk, inks by Leonard Kirk, Danielle Orlandini, and Corey Hampshire, colours by Arif Prianto, and letters by VC's Joe Caramagna. So this is a prequel to Solo, you know, that prequel film.
So it's a prequel to a prequel?
It is a prequel to a prequel.
So it's a pre-re-requel. Pre-requel?
Prequel.
Prequel.
That doesn't work at all. From what I understand, having admittedly not actually seen Solo,
do you really want to?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm one of those people who feels like I don't necessarily care about what Han Solo's backstory is.
See, that's the thing. I never really bothered with Han Solo's backstory. I didn't think it was going to be all that interesting, and it turned out it wasn't.
Yeah, because it's just a bunch of stuff happened that he became a smuggler.
Yeah. Oh, look, he's a poor kid from the streets. He grew up to be a smuggler.
Anyway, but yeah, so this, I think it starts at the beginning of Solo, where he escapes off the planet Corellia, but his girlfriend Kira gets captured. So he decides he's going to join the Imperial Navy and then eventually make his way back there so he can rescue her. Also, I forgot that this was a thing in the film as well, that like, his name isn't Han Solo. It's just, he gets the last name Solo when he applies for the Imperial Navy because he's on his own. It's just, why? Just let that be his last name because it's his last name.
What was his name before then? What was his surname before Solo?
I think he didn't have one, basically.
Oh, maybe he did. He was just too embarrassed to tell people. Maybe it was D-Man.
Don't be silly, Rob. It's a sci-fi universe, so it needs to be Zoth.
I was going to go with D. Shandy, but...
Getting rid of Mick was a mistake.
Yes, it was.
Is it too late to fish him back out of that ocean? I mean paperwork.
We'll need a crane. I mean, the concrete shoes was a bit much, I think.
Anyway, back to Han Solo. So, yeah, this... I think the idea of the miniseries is it takes place during the events of Han's time in the Imperial Navy, which I presume the film maybe doesn't go into that much detail about.
No.
And it's just, it's kind of an alright series. It's just, it's very, kind of basically like any war film you've seen.
Yeah.
So, you know, he joins the Navy, he's mouthy, and the superiors don't like that, and he gets on his other cadets' nerves, but then through a series of hijinks, they become true friends for life.
Okay.
Which, yeah, you know, kind of fairly basic premise. But, yeah, I don't really... It does manage to have a bit of fun with it. I tell a few nice stories. Like, there's a bit where, basically, as an apology for messing up Han, kind of fixes a cruiser's engine so they'll get to port a day sooner than they should, and then has them use that extra day to go to a space casino. It's a fun little bit.
Does he introduce himself as Han Bond or something like that?
No, he does not. Yeah, it's like I said though, it's a lot of stuff you'll have seen before if you've seen like any kind of war movie or story of that ilk. And I think so. Also, the other two main problems are it's only 5 issues long, and I feel like, you know, that's just not really enough time to kind of build up a rapport between the characters. Who, you'll note, I'm calling the characters because I don't remember the other people's names.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is it one of those stories where you need to have watched the Solo movie?
Not really. I would say it kind of works quite well as its own individual thing.
Okay.
But it's also, it's a part of Han Solo's backstory that isn't necessarily that important.
Yeah.
It's just basically filling in it. So I think he doesn't actually abandon the movie in this. I think he does that in the film. It's just, you know, kind of his some adventures he got up to while he was there.
Okay.
But it doesn't really, it's like, it's not important to his growth as a character, really.
All right, yeah.
He goes in with the expectation that he's going to bug out the first chance he gets, and he's still going to do that by the end of the series.
Because that's the story of his life.
Because the concept, I think, if it wasn't Han Solo, it would work well as a series of someone like who maybe joins the Imperial Navy, kind of starts off being a bit cocky, but kind of slowly learns to make friends and get the respect of their superiors, only to then have that kind of, oh no, wait, we're the baddies moment.
Yeah.
Because the climax of the miniseries is one of the characters kind of realizing that, and they help her abandon the cause. But it's just, it doesn't really have any weight to it.
It's fluff.
Yeah, exactly. There's also a backup story in the back. Close the bits for tell you the people who did the things, which is Star Wars Beckett issue 1, which is written by Jerry Duggan with art by Edgar Salazar, Mark Lamb, Will Sliney, and colours by Jordan Boyd, letters by VC's Travis Lanham. And this is a bit of backstory for Beckett, who I think is like Han Solo's mentor character in the book. And yeah, actually that one's quite a lot of fun. It's just about them kind of basically doing a con to steal some identity cards. And it's just a fun little heist story. Kind of got a bit of Firefly to it.
Awesome.
Yeah, so that was a nice little sweet treat.
Cool. So me again then, is it?
Yeah, back to you.
And back to horror. In England in 1577, with only her wits to aid her, teenage Mabel is forced to fight for her life as Black Shuck, the mystic beast that inspired Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Hound of the Baskervilles, wreaks terror on her once peaceful village.
Incident. Can I complain about Black Shuck for a second?
Yes.
Because what the hell, British mythology? We have so many good monsters that you can draw from.
Yep.
And then someone comes along and says, what if just a big dog?
Well, there's a bit more to Black Shuck than that, kind of.
He's a big dog with red eyes.
Yes, he is. And this is The Burning Black.
What's that, Hamish? You saw a big black dog on the moors? Yeah, you probably did.
Yeah, see a skinny guy wearing a tracksuit with it? Because if so, then we know where the dog came from. But anyway, this is The Burning Black, The Legend of Black Shuck. And this is by Mark Allard-Will, with art by Ryan Howe, Justin Schauf, and Locke Nguyen. Colours and letters by Elaine M. Will. And this actually starts off in Eddington, in England, in May 878, when Guthrum of the Danes witnessed the division of the Saxon kingdom and saw his opportunity to strike. And he marched towards Wessex. He'd been unstoppable. But then he did get stopped and he surrendered, right? And as part of that surrender, he basically adopted Christianity, leaving behind the old pagan gods. And then it goes on to the curse of Odin and everything like that, and how the basically, after signing Alfred's treaty, Guthrum returned home, but then he got sick. And then things happened. Horrible, bloody things happened.
Okay, because I was going to say up until that point, this story has included both the terms. He was unstoppable until he wasn't. And then some things happened.
I know.
Which is maybe not a saga for the ages.
Well, it's not. But basically, this is a story that's being told by a beggar to a small child in the area of Bungay in England. On August the 4th, 1577. And the child obviously cries, and some adult man says, beggar, you've come around telling those stories again, and starts beating up the beggar and everything like that. So the beggar says, right, okay, you stupid villagers, let's have some vengeance, shall we? And the beggar does some magic with his bird, a baby bird that he's got, and the baby bird he kills, and then he comes back to life, and then the weather changes, the sky gets dark, thunder roars, lightning strikes, and people are hiding in their homes, when suddenly the guy who beat up the beggar, on his roof, something lands. He's not sure what, and then you just see fangs, and there's a growl, and a scream, and half his body ends up on the roof.
See, he's just a beggar with an angry dog.
Yes.
Do you know what I call that? I call that Stockton High Street.
See, there's a great bit in this where the guy leans out the window to see what's happening. His wife pulls him back in, his head's missing. And then somehow the village is burning, and just this massive dog beast with red eyes is attacking everybody. But Mabel, she takes shelter at the church, and the cross has fallen off the church, and the cross seems to burn the dog. It seems to be an anathema to the dog, or to the beast, whatever it is. And that then ends the tale of The Legend of Black Shuck, with some guy who looks remarkably like Hank Hill, sitting at a desk, doing his best, Lemony Snicket impression, I suppose you'd say, going, hello, dear readers, thanks for joining me. Whilst the story you've read is a fictionalized dramatization of the story of Black Shuck, crafted by me and my team of artists, colourists, and letterer, it's based upon the real events of Shuck's most famed appearances, that of the 4th of August 1577 in Bungay and Blytheburg in the county of Suffolk in England.
But again, all of that said by Hank Hill.
All of that said by Hank Hill, yes. He looks remarkably like Hank Hill.
But I take it back that this book gets a pass from me.
See, this is the thing. I understand the legend of Blackshuck and everything like that. It's got an interesting idea behind this. It's got some great artwork at the back about the legend of Blackshuck. But I don't know. See, my problem with these sorts of things is that when you take something that is already fantastical and you make it more fantastic, you run the risk of heading in the other direction, so it becomes kind of parody. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And there are parts of this where they've basically added and embellished the original tale of Blackshuck, and it makes it a little bit... See, the original tale of Blackshuck doesn't really need much embellishment. It's a story of a big black dog killing people, and nobody knows where the dog came from or where it went. But there continue to be sightings of this of said big black dog over the years and centuries since that time. Just like the Beast of Bodmin Moor.
I can't feel with stuff like this. A lot of the fun with urban legends is kind of the sort of hearsay.
Yeah.
Ooh, I'm telling you, this is definitely a true story, maybe wink. And just maybe turn it into a comic. Kind of makes it too, like, definitively fictional.
Yeah, and that's my point. That's why I said it takes it too far the other way and turns it into, say, parody. And then you just end up going, it's not real.
Everyone knows dogs don't exist.
I mean, this is the thing, right? The Legend of Blackshuck, if I was going to pair it with anything, I'd say that final scene involving General Woundwort in Watership Down, the cartoon movie, the original one, where he's saying, dogs aren't dangerous, and then you see the dog, the big black dog, barking with blood dripping from its jaws, and you see General Woundwort with blood dripping from his jaws, launching himself at the dog.
And that's the sequel to Blackshuck.
The greatest enemy of Blackshuck, the rabbit.
And then we smash cut to Eye of the Tiger.
Yes. Training montage involving the Duracell buddy. On that note, I think we're going to head over to you, Andrew.
Boy, I just can't wait for Mothman versus Blackshuck.
Yes.
Anyway, I guess the next one I've got is kind of about stuff what is mysterious.
Okay.
So I've been reading Memories of Eminon, Volume 1.
Oh, yes.
So this is drawn... And I guess written as well by Kenji Tsuruta.
Yes.
But based off the original story by Shinji Keijo.
Yep.
Or Kajio. One of those two, or possibly neither, almost definitely. So this is about a young man. Actually, before I start the summary, I will just give ahead. If you're not aware of the story, I am basically just going to spoil the whole thing, because there's kind of way I can talk about it otherwise.
There isn't really any way you can talk about Memories of Eminon without spoiling it, so this will involve massive spoilers of the first volume only, though.
Yep, so it is the year 1969. A young man is taking a ferry back to mainland Japan, where he ends up bumping into a young woman, and they strike up a conversation, and kind of... Eventually, she tells him this story about how she's actually 3 billion years old.
Yeah.
With the idea that every time she dies, all her memories are kind of... Well, it's not even when she dies, it's kind of when she gives birth, her descendant kind of inherits of like the collective memories of her entire line. And so she is like a living record of all of human history.
Yeah.
Yeah, and obviously in the book, the twist is supposed to be that kind of... She says that, but then later says that she was just joking. But then at the end, he kind of meets her again. She doesn't recognize him. But then her identical-looking daughter comes up and says, yeah, turns out I wasn't joking.
See, it's a fascinating concept, isn't it?
It is. It's really interesting. Just the idea like, of remembering every single past life.
Yeah.
And I really like... Because in this, she's quite, you know, upset. You know, she kind of feels like, why am I burdened with this? But I just love the idea that, like, he kind of comes up with just, you are, like, ensuring that at least someone remembers everything that's happened for, like, all of humanity.
Yeah.
And I love the idea of, like, this kind of wandering, like, living record.
And I love the reason why she connected with that guy as well. Such a simple reason.
That's just, like, he reminds her of one of her husbands.
That's it. Nothing complicated. It wasn't any eyes met across a crowded ballroom or anything like that. It was just like, hey, it reminds me of one of my husbands.
And it's nice. And I really love that, like, from his perspective, he meets this woman once, and she kind of, like, leaves him in the middle of the night, and he kind of spends the next, like, 30 years thinking, or is it, like, the next 10 years.
Yeah.
Thinking, oh, my, what if I had gone with her? But then you kind of get this sweet thing of, you kind of can take comfort in the fact that because of her memory, like, whether it's one night or 10 years, that's all the same to her.
Yeah.
And so she's always going to remember him.
Yeah. And it's such a, I love that sentiment that someone else, because it's that whole thing, you know, you're only truly dead when the world forgets your name.
Yeah, and I love the idea of, like, no matter how insignificant, like, you think your life might be,
yeah,
you still mattered to someone.
Yeah.
But it reminds me a lot of a film called Twilight Samurai.
Yes, yes. Good call. Like,
yeah, because, and again, to spoil that film for everyone, it's about this samurai who's in love with a woman, and in the end they get together, but then it's revealed that, like, a year later he had to go off to a war and ended up dying. But it ends with, like, his daughter is in this lovely sentiment about, I choose not to be sad that, you know, he didn't get to enjoy having his true love for long. It's the fact, like, he had it at all, and that's what's important.
Yeah.
And that's just, that's such a really neat sentiment. And yeah. I love it a lot. And yeah, I freaking love Eminem now.
I'll tell you, right, Mick didn't want this, and I really wanted one of you two to read it. I've read Memories of Eminem, and Eminem is, well, you know what the word means.
Yeah, it's, so I'll admit, initially I was like, wow, this must be some, like, cool, obscure Japanese word that means, like, a person who has no name and therefore no identity.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, no, wait, it's the English word no name spelled backwards.
Yep. Again, so simple. But the thing is, when you think about it, right, calling herself Eminem, it makes total sense because, effectively, she is 3 billion years old. Her concept of time is so out of whack with what we think. She has no sense of urgency. Well, nothing of that sort at all.
Yeah. Like, it's also a nice reference to the idea that, like, she's not just her. She's also, like, these millions of people that she's been throughout all of history.
Yeah. And the other thing is, it's not just in her genetic makeup. There's something more at work because if you think about it, in 3 billion years, there are going to be plenty of times she's actually died before she's given birth.
Actually, okay, so does it actually go into that?
Yes, it does.
Okay, cool, because I thought that was, like, one of the
questions that you had.
I had at the end of this one.
I knew you were going to have that question, and it does go into that, okay?
Yeah. I was like, that it specifically goes into, it's at, like, once the next generation's been born, that's when the memory's passed down.
Yeah.
And then, the previous version of her just doesn't remember any of these past lives.
I love this series because it is just, it's, there's something magical about Memories of Eminem. It's one of those rare manga where I do not want to see it adapted in any way. I think it's perfect just as it is, just as a manga, where you can just appreciate the artwork, you can appreciate the pacing, you can read it in your own time. There's no rush, and I think that's part of the reason for it. I think that's part of how you should read it. Just don't rush it.
Oh, yeah, it's another one of these kind of very slow, thoughtful processes that I like.
Yeah.
I mean, cause, again, just reflecting the idea that she's just sort of casually drifting throughout all human history.
Yeah.
Just so freaking good.
And the artwork's great, isn't it?
It's really, like, especially the facial expressions are just, they're on point. And, like, even without doing any of the usual kind of over-the-top, big eyes, very expressive, it's like, you can just tell all these emotions in, like, these tiny little, like, turns of the lip.
Yeah.
And by all these emotions, I mean predominantly wistful sadness, the best emotion.
Yeah. And if anyone's earned that emotion.
Yeah, exactly. So she kind of stares out at the empty night sky with a cigarette loosely hanging out her lips.
Yeah, but she pulls it off because she's probably done it 1,000 times.
Yeah, I think it's just, it's amazing that the art does manage to capture, like, just this sense of she's someone who has seen so much. Like, you just, it's hard to go, just seeing her on the page, you just know, like, yeah, she knows.
Yeah, she does.
She's got that something. she is who Bananarama was singing about.
Yeah. Actually, she is, isn't she, when you think about it? Even in that first volume.
Yeah. Also, I like, it's one of those things, one of my favourite little bonuses of just, like, an interesting translation tidbit at the back.
Yes.
Because they've got an interview with both creators, and one of the interviews with, yeah, the one with Shinji Kajio, he mentions, I think basically uses a euphemism about how his publisher suggesting that he write more Eminon was like water being poured into a writer's ear. Which is, I think, a Japanese euphemism.
Yeah.
But then there's a whole, like, bit at the back by the translator, Dana Lewis, I believe her name is. That just going through this whole interesting process of saying, like, there's always a debate to be had when you translate Japanese euphemisms. Like, do you give the literal translation, even though that's maybe going to make it come across as more strange and exotic, or do you kind of maybe try and rephrase it into, like, an English idiom to really try and capture the sense of this is just, like, an everyday expression. And there's, like, yeah, it's an interesting debate between, like, literal translation versus maintaining intent, but then also throwing in this idea of, but is it not better to maybe, like, learn more about these languages as we build kind of a more multicultural society?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those things that makes you appreciate that translation is more than just, like, slapping a bunch of words into Google and getting the literal meanings.
That doesn't work, trust me. It does not help, especially if you're overseas. Do not try that method.
Yeah. I mean, especially, it's interesting with a language like Japanese, where there are lots of phrases that have kind of layers of meaning.
Yeah.
That's always interesting, seeing how you try and capture that and how you, like, fill someone with your grace or whatever.
Yes.
People are mad about the Neil Genitals evangelism.
The new genital evangelism.
Yeah, that's it.
Because calling them neon, I'm sorry, but there's something wrong if they've gone neon.
I mean, that's just the power of our Lord and Saviour.
You may need to
see on our earthly bodies.
You may need to see a doctor. Anyway, is it my turn?
I know what that anime is about. It is your turn.
It is my turn. Because I have something wonderfully delightful, right? Now, I've literally just noticed this on the cover of this, and I do want to bring it up. Because this is Fantastic Four, Mr. and Mrs. Grimm. And this collects Fantastic Four Wedding Special number 1, Fantastic Four number 5, and also has Fantastic Four 1961 number 8. Now, on the cover of this, you have Ben Grimm, who is wearing a skull cap and one of those shawls that Jewish people wear at weddings. And I didn't know he was Jewish, so I apologize for not knowing that Ben Grimm was Jewish.
Yeah, he definitely is.
I mean,
I know that because I read the series in which he has his bar mitzvah.
Yeah, and Alicia Masters, and it is about their wedding. But in the background, you have flames forming a heart shape, and then you have a heart shape. Now, I've literally just noticed that the flames are being formed by Johnny Storm, and the heart shape line is being formed by Reed Richards' arms.
So, those nerds.
I know. It literally is. Because I looked at it and went, oh, those nerds. So anyway, this is by a great lineup of writers, Gail Simone, Dan Slott, and Fred Hembeck, with art by Laura Braga, Mark Buckingham, Mark Farmer, and Fred Hembeck. Colours by Jesus Abatov, Matt Yaki, and Megan Wilson. Letters by VCs Joe Caramagna and Fred Hembeck. And cover art by Carlos Pacheco and Romulo Fajardo Jr. And Fantastic Four number 5 was written by Dan Slott. And art for 4-Minute Warning was by Aaron Kuda. Colors by Marta Gracia, Eric Arciniga. Change partners by Michael Allred. Art by Michael Allred and colors by Laura Allred. Guys Night Out, the art was done by Adam Hughes, letters by VCs Joe Caramagna, and cover art by Esad Ribic. Now, that's a lot of names that I've just said, but I did want to bring them all up because this is, well, do you remember that time when we talked about Rick Jones's wedding and the Stag Night that came before it?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. That was some series of comics. So this starts off with the Mole Man, right? It starts off with a wedding invitation. We cordially invite you to the wedding of Alicia Rice Masters and Benjamin Jacob Grimm. And then it goes through Invisible Girls Gone Wild, which is written by Gail Simone, Father Figure by Dan Slott, Puppet Masters Lament by Fred Hembeck. And it starts off with a wall full of pictures of the Mole Man. And one of them is basically, you know, the sexy guy in the briefs leaning to the side, you know, just lying down sideways. Somebody's pasted a picture of Mole Man's head on top of that body.
You say somebody, but it was definitely Mole Man that did that.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't Mole Man. It wasn't.
Oh, wait, no, it wasn't, was it? Oh, I remember now.
You know who it was. Don't say it. But anyway, Sue and Alicia are going on Alicia's bachelorette party, take one of her bachelorette party, and her bachelorette party is being organised by one of Alicia's friends, Alicia's arts friends, called Ricky. And there are also other people who are joining them, her two of Alicia's other friends from the art collective that she's part of, Argo and Delia. Johnny, on the other hand, is in a rush to basically go for some last-minute libations for Ben's soiree, runs out and runs in almost headfirst into Jennifer Walters, Medusa, and Crystal, just as he's saying the legendary line, "A night of legendary debauchery." And Crystal goes, "Hello, Johnny. I did not quite catch that. What were you saying tonight would be?" And Johnny suddenly got to Sue. So many ex-girlfriends. So many. Help.
Oh, Johnny Storm, you are a disaster.
He is. Jennifer goes, "Don't flatter yourself, Johnny." Medusa says, "I've had better. We've all had better." And Leosk, who is their chauffeur for the night, says, "Yes, yes, he is not attentive to your needs as Randy Scallions. Yes, yes, it is established. May we get going, ladies. Leosk has a schedule."
Gee, but if only I can remember who it was that wrote this story.
It was Gail Simone.
It's so
Gail Simone.
It's one of the most Gail Simone things I've ever read.
It is. I mean, Randy Scallions is my phrase of the week.
It's definitely going to be the name of my firstborn child.
So anyway, they end up at a club, a strip club, a ladies strip club called World War Hunk.
Yep.
Which is a superhero themed strip club.
Yep.
And then the Mole Man attacks, but it's not the Mole Man. It's the woman who is in love with the Mole Man, but he don't notice her. And the Mole Man basically, he doesn't want any of this. He just wants to be left alone in peace now. He's happy as he is. But what's her name? Kala, the woman who basically kept saying she loved the Mole Man and then eventually got spurned by the loneliest man in the world, which made her the loneliest woman in the world, and now she just wants the Mole Man.
It turns out the Mole Man doesn't like having a creepy stalker.
Yeah, I know. It's the irony of ironies. before they've gone, Ben has been said to Sue, keep it normal, no superhero stuff. Superhero stuff leads to shenanigans. The problem is, they can't even be around fake superhero stuff without shenanigans happening.
They're just a shenanigans magnet.
Yeah, because they are the Fantastic Four. The second one, this one is decidedly creepy in certain ways, right? Alicia sends Ben off and he's wearing a suit and he's on his Fantastic Bike, whatever it's called, and he ends up at the prison. Is he at the raft?
Yeah, I think it's the raft.
Yeah, raft, or maximum security. Yeah. And as he's going through the prison, there's some guy going, I'll kill you, thing. If I get out of here, you're dead. Smash you into pebbles, rock, into little pebbles, rock man. And Ben goes, psst, pulverizer, how'd you do on your GED? Pulverizer goes, great, Ben. Thanks for helping me with my algebra. I'm going for my college degree next. Good on you. I'll say hi to your ma. You heard me. You're dead, man, Grim.
That's exactly what I want in the thing.
Yeah, and the person that Ben is going to see is the person that Ben's got loads of beef with, but it's the person that Ben really needs to see because he's an old-school guy, right? He's old-school, and he's so old-school that stuff like old-school values, tradition, a code to follow, doing the honourable thing, they're important to Ben. And so he has gone to see Alicia's stepdad.
Who is, of course, the Puppet Master.
Yep. Isn't his name like Philip Masters or something like that?
Yeah, I think so.
P Master, because I remember it was supposed to rhyme with, it was supposed to be like P Master. Oh, he's the Puppet Master. And so, yeah.
As far as like villainous alter ego, that one's a bit rubbish, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. But the Puppet Master is an interesting Fantastic Four villain, because he was always a bit lamer than he actually was. Given his skill set and his abilities, he should have been far more of a threat. But anyway, Ben and the Puppet Master don't get on, but he's gone to do the right thing, ask for Alicia's dad's blessing to get married to her. And he gives it, right? And Ben's really, really happy. And he goes home. He runs home to Alicia and says, he gave his blessing. Yay! Right? And he says, I'm going to call Uncle Jake and Aunt Petunia. And I've been waiting a long time to see Aunt Petunia because he's talked about her a lot. But before Alicia goes, she takes out something and puts it away safely. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but it's decidedly unnerving, and it suggests that, it suggests a lot of things about Alicia.
Yeah, I apart from the bit with Pulverizer, I didn't much like this story.
Yeah.
I think it's also. I think I probably would have preferred it if maybe, like, Puppet Master had said no, and like Thing had just said, you know, actually this tradition is. So, it would be like more about the Thing realizing,
yeah,
that asking for someone's father's hand in marriage, like his daughter's hand in marriage, it's antiquated and doesn't need to be done.
Yeah. But then it goes on to the main story, which starts off on Yancey Street. Reed has been remodeling. Sue is trying to get everyone ready. Ben one needs to learn how to dance. And while they're dancing, Sue reminisces about their history. How Ben used to be challenging Reed for Sue Storm. She chose Reed over Ben. And then how the Puppet Master basically got involved and Alicia looked exactly like Sue once she put on a blonde wig. And that's how they managed to trick everyone. And so, yeah, that's the next story. I'm not sure whether I like that story or not, but...
Yeah, I think I maybe would have preferred if they'd just forgotten about the whole Alicia looks exactly like Sue thing, because it's a bit...
It's interesting because Ben does say to Sue, she's not you, you know, and he does make it clear that he loves Alicia because she's not Sue Storm, which is a nice little kind of sentiment there that they're trying to crowbar in, but they're using a very big hammer.
Yeah, I think I would have just preferred it if they just didn't look alike.
Yeah, but then it goes on to Guy's Night Out, and Guy's Night Out is a lot of fun as a story. And that one's, this is the one where Johnny has basically organized the bachelor party, and this is where it gets very much like the stag do. So you've got this city bus that Johnny has rented called the Storm Bus, and you've got Peter Quill and Rocket singing the, you know that song, Some People Call Me the Space Cowboy, Some People Call Me the Gangster of Love?
Oh, the Joker.
Yeah.
by the Steve Miller Band.
Quill and Rocket are singing that outside, out of one of the windows of the bus, and people are getting on the bus. Johnny has literally gone full Johnny on this, and he's basically invited D-Man, Vance Astro, and Wunder. And Wunder has basically brought good tidings for his friend and gives him a copy of The Herald, which is for the coming of Galactus. All hail he who is both Lifebringer and Devourer.
Of his weird, like, new world religion.
Yes. And I just love that. And then Spider-Man turns up and Ben's going, oh, who invited this guy? He's like, speaking of invites, I haven't got one to the wedding yet. We ain't having capes at the wedding. We're keeping it small, a family thing. Spidey's going, but, and he's like, but nothing. You add heroes to a wedding and shenanigans happen. Not this time. But I wrote a really good wedding speech. No speeches, no shenanigans. Bachelor party and that's it. But no.
Just doesn't want no trouble in his place.
Thundra, she's supposed to head off with the ladies for the bachelorette party. But she's not having any of it because she's a femizone warrior and she wants to go where the men are having fun. So she joins the party bus while Johnny's just looking at the ladies who are going to the bachelorette party. And he's going, dated her, married a scroll of her, dated her, hit on her. It's like my little black book of failure. So the first place Johnny takes Ben is to the UCW match, where he is the former champion, and he gets invited to get back in the ring. That leads to a brilliant scene where he's lying on a slab in the changing room's going, ow, I shouldn't have done that. So what's the prognosis, Doc? And Strange goes, as a world-renowned surgeon and master of mystic arts, I'm a bit overqualified, but I can confirm that you pulled your groin. And I love the idea of the Thing, who is basically made of bricks, can still pull his groin.
Yeah, I think he just like do a hammy or something.
Yeah. That leads to drinks in a bar, which is then invaded by the Serpent Society, who jump out from giant cakes. Big punch-up ensues, which basically ends up with Johnny hitting on one of the members of the Serpent Society, the female members of the Serpent Society, and getting punched in the face for it. Meanwhile, because Ben is tied up by one of the giant snakes and going, yowch, boy, I sure hope the girls' night is going better than this. And then it cuts to this full-page scene, really well-drawn, of Jennifer going, woo! And you got Alicia at the front just going, what? And saying, so you're saying clockwise and now counterclockwise. Ooh. I wonder what they're staring at.
The clock's obviously wrong. We're all very time conscious.
I love that page because it's a bit of a callback to the old Rick Jones Stag Night.
Yeah, just like this, a modern day version of that comic.
It is. But done so much better because Ben's got his head on straight. He's not losing the plot or anything like that. Not having a steel mask with lemons shoved in the eyes. Then it goes on to the poker game, which starts off friendly until Thor decides to go all in and raises it with his arm and ends with all the guys basically wearing their underpants and Thundra, who's won everything, including Thor's helmet, sunglasses, cigars, you name it, she's won it all, and says, "Hatest not the plague, Benjamin Grimm."
Thundra's pretty great.
I mean, this is basically, it's got some shaky moments, but it really is a really fun comic and a really sweet comic, and it hits home just how much of a family these folks are, including Alicia, how much of a part of the Fantastic Four and the wider Fantastic Four family Alicia Masters Grimm, or just Alicia Grimm, whatever she chooses, but how much of a part of this family that she is. Because even the threat of Galactus starting to eat the planet Earth through Latveria and Doctor Doom saying, I'm going to deal with it because of Reed Richards and his wimpy band can, I can too. Even in the midst of that and in the face of that, Reed still pulls out 4 extra minutes so they can finish the wedding without extra shenanigans. And Alicia's words to Ben is clobberum.
Very nice. That's a sweet issue. Reminds me, I really like that Fantastic Four series that's out at the moment. You know the one, The Terrifics.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
That's what the kids nowadays call shade.
Yeah, I know. But then it goes on to some of the classic Fantastic Four comics with the...
Which I'm sure are grace.
Prisoners of the Puppet Master. And then it's got some artwork at the back as well. But yeah, I like this. And I like that they've given it to different writers to write different parts of it. Obviously, the Gail Simone story... Well, it's pure Gail Simone. What's not to love about that?
Although I feel like it does continue to prove a point that there are much better writers that could have been given the Fantastic Four series.
Yeah, and that's the bit that confuses me, because the Invisible Girls Gone Wild, written by Gail Simone, the final story, Guy's Night Out, if I remember rightly, is Dan Slott.
Yeah, Dan Slott was kind of the main writer for the series and has been kind of a bit underwhelming.
But the Guy's Night Out is actually a lot of fun. And that's what I think is the main thing for this series. I think the Fantastic Four should be one of those quirky... You know those quirky sitcoms that have some bits of drama, but generally are about a family unit and just the trials and tribulations of a family unit?
Yeah, it's basically one of those.
Yeah, that's what the Fantastic Four should be. They don't need to be wisecracking and making jokes and all that stuff like Spider-Man does all the time. They don't need any of that. They just need... I mean, the in-jokes. There's so many in-jokes for the Fantastic Four because they're a family that anybody... Well, basically everybody will get because... Well, I say everybody, sorry. Most people will get because most people have grown up with family.
Yeah, pretty much. I think we're maybe at the end of the show.
We are. We're at the end of the show. So, anyway, that's been it for our comics blowout for June, is it? Yeah, June.
Yep, that is the month what it is at the moment.
So, we will see you all next time. But before then, some messages. If you want to listen to any of our other episodes or any of our other shows that we do here at The Geek Show, then you can find them on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, or you can find them on Audioboom, Acast, Stitcher, whatever your podcast provider is. We're also on Apple Podcasts and YouTube as well. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so just studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. If you want to support us, you'll find our shop and our Patreon on our website. Until next time, I've been Rob.
And I've been Andrew.
And we will see you all later.
Thanks for listening.